Welcome to Urban Dharma, the podcast, where suffering is optional. Hi, this is Reverend Kusla coming to you from downtown Los Angeles, from the International Buddhist Meditation Center in the heart of Koreatown. It's a warm and sunny day in Los Angeles, and what you're about to hear is a talk I gave on May 10th at Chadwick School in Palos Verdes, California, to a comparative religions class. The teacher, Terry Andrews, emailed me some of the questions the students had, and I took those questions with me, and I encouraged some live questions as well. So what you're about to hear is a question and answer session at Chadwick School in Palos Verdes, California. Okay, well, really good questions. And so I'm going to start with the longest answer, one of the shortest questions and the longest answer. And so I was doing my research last night. And this came from the 1105 class, number one. Anybody here from 1105, number one? Okay. Is there a creation myth in Buddhism? According to Buddhism, how did the world come into being? So anybody think there's a creation myth in Buddhism? After all your reading and stuff? Yeah, it really seems like there isn't one. But as it turns out, there is one. And it's found in the Digha Nikaya. And I'm going to leave this with you so you can have your very own copy of the Buddhist creation myth. So this is the Agana Sutta, the knowledge of beings. It's also in the Digha Nikaya, the long discourses. In Buddhism, we have something called the Tipitaka. The Tipitaka is the three baskets. And the second basket are the sutras, and in the sutras they are classified as long discourses, middle-length discourses. So we have the Digha Nikaya, the Majjhima Nikaya, the Anguttara Nikaya, which are the numbered discourses. This is found in number 27 of the long discourses. And so somebody was asking the Buddha about, well, how did this thing all start, you know? And in Buddhism, there's always a moral aspect to it. It's never just totally philosophical, though it seems like it sometimes, but there's always a moral thing happening. So I'm just going to read some of this, but for me this was really fascinating, because when I first became aware of creation myths, I was looking at it in just a really sort of relative, practical way, that this is how the world started. But then as I started to meditate and study Buddhism some more, to me, and I'm going to qualify it, to me, it seems, the creation myths we have in most every religion in the world is not talking about how the world started. To me, the creation myths are talking about how our self-consciousness started. When did we have the ability to be self-reflective? When did self arise? Because we're the only creature in the whole world that has the ability to be self-reflective. We have a self, we have an ego, which can be a good thing and it can be a bad thing. So when I look at the creation myths, I'm seeing this is when the ego started to come out of the subconsciousness. And who was that first person? And it really must have been a trip to wake up in that way. Because now you're the only one that's awake and everybody else is still sleeping. You know? And so you can look in the water and see your face. And other people just look in the water and see water. And then you can see your hand. And you realize your hand is separate. And you can start to use it in ways the other people couldn't, because they can't see the separateness of the hand. Now, to take it another step, we could say, well, we can watch the creation myth in every human being that's born. We can see the evolution of human consciousness in every baby. And so when they're first born, they're just totally dependent. The universe is them, they're the universe. And eventually they start to recognize mom. And then they start to recognize the fact they have hands and feet. And then they actually start to talk, you know, and have words and concepts that apply to unrelated things in the world. Like the word chair, the sound chair, has absolutely nothing to do with a chair. Does it? It's just we have been taught that that sound represents that form. But in reality, they have no true connection. So now we sort of become abstract, and now we're able to name things. And once we're able to name them, we can use them to the good or bad, you know. And it's just, for me, it was fascinating to go in this direction. So after doing some reading in Buddhism, I always said, no, there's no creation myth. The Buddha never talked about it. But then I'm looking at Digha Nikaya number 27, I'm going, son of a gun, we have one too. You know? But it wasn't an original creation myth. I'm pretty sure it was borrowed from Brahmanism or Hinduism, because the Buddha was a Hindu until he died. Just like Christ was a Jew until he died. So he didn't create a new myth. He just used the old one. So here we go. There comes a time, Vasetta, who he's speaking to, when sooner or later, after a long period, this world contracts. So we're talking about expansion, contraction, which may parallel some of our understanding in astronomy, you know, and how the universe expands and contracts. At the time of contraction, beings are mostly born in the Abhasa Brahma world. And there they dwell, mind-made, feeding on delight, self-luminous, moving through the air, glorious. And they stay like that for a very long time. But sooner or later, after a long period, this world begins to expand again. At a time of expansion, the beings in the Brahma world, having passed away from there, are mostly reborn in this world. Here they dwell, mind-made, feeding on delight, self-luminous, moving through the air, glorious. And they stay like that for a very, very long time. So they don't have their bodies yet. They're just this radiant consciousness. And they're feeding on happiness and bliss. That's their food. Wouldn't it be great to just sustain yourself on happiness and bliss? Can you imagine going to McDonald's and having a side order of happiness, you know? At that period, there was just one mass of water, and all was darkness, blinding darkness. Neither moon nor sun appeared, nor constellation or stars appeared. Night and day were not yet distinguished, nor months and fortnights, nor years and seasons. There was no male and female, beings being reckoned just as beings. So there wasn't any distinction yet. That dualistic interpretation of the world that the ego gives us hadn't arisen yet. And sooner or later, after a very long period of time, savory earth spread itself over the waters where those beings were. It looked just like the skin that forms itself over a hot milk as it cools. It was endowed with color, smell, and taste. It was the color of fine ghee or butter. And it was very sweet, just like pure wild honey. Then some being of a greedy nature said, now see, this is where the moral aspect of Buddhism comes in. What are the three poisons in Buddhism? Greed, hatred, and delusion. This greedy being with a greedy nature said, I say, what can this be? And tasted the savory earth on its finger. In so doing, it became taken with the flavor and craving, and it arose. Now, doesn't that sound sort of like Eve eating the apple? Don't eat the apple. So this guy puts his finger in the ghee-like earth and tastes it and says, wow, that is so cool. They too were taken with the flavor, and craving arose in all of them. So they set out to, with their hands, breaking up pieces of this stuff in order to eat it. And as a result, their self-luminous disappeared. And as a result of the disappearance of their self-luminous, the moon and the sun appeared. Night and day were distinguished. Months and fortnights appeared. And the year and its seasons. To that extent, the world re-evolved. So here we go. You see that connection in there? And those being continued for a long time feasting on the savory earth, feeding on it and being nourished by it. And as they did so, their bodies became coarser and a difference in looks developed among them. Some beings became good-looking, while others became ugly. And the good-looking ones were despised by the others, saying, "We are better-looking than they are." And because they became arrogant and conceited about their looks, the savory earth disappeared. And at this time they came together and lamented, crying, "Oh, that flavor! Oh, that flavor!" And so nowadays when people say, "Oh, that flavor," when they get something nice, they are repeating an ancient saying without realizing it. And then when the savory earth disappeared and a fungus cropped up in the manner of a mushroom, it was of good color, smell, and taste. It was the color of fine ghee or butter, and it was very sweet, like pure wild honey. And those being set to and ate the fungus. And this lasted for a very long time, and as they continued to feed on the fungus, so their bodies became coarser still, and the difference in their looks increased still more, and the good-looking ones despised the others. And because they became arrogant and conceited about their looks, the sweet fungus disappeared. Next, creepers appeared, shooting up like bamboo, and they too were very sweet, like pure wild honey. And those being set to and fed on those creepers, and as they did so, their bodies became even coarser, and the difference in their looks increased still more, and they became more arrogant. And so the creepers disappeared too. At this, they came together and lamented, crying, "Alas, our creepers are gone. What have we lost?" And so now today, when people, one being asked why they are upset, they might say, "Oh, what have we lost?" And they are repeating an ancient saying without realizing it. And then after the creepers disappeared, rice appeared in open spaces, free from powder and from husks, fragrant and clean grain. And what they say had taken in the evening for supper and had grown again and was ripe in the morning, and what they had taken in the morning for breakfast and was ripe again in the evening, with no sign of reaping. And these being set to and fed on this rice, and this lasted for a very long time. And as they did so, their bodies became coarser still, and the difference in their looks became even greater. And the females developed female sex organs, and the males developed male sex organs. And the women became excessively preoccupied with men, and the men with women. Owing to this excessive preoccupation with each other, passion was aroused, and their bodies burnt with lust. And later, because of this burning, they indulged in sexual activity. But those who saw them indulging through dust and ashes and cow dung at them, crying, "Die, you filthy beast! How can one being do such things to another?" Just as today in some districts, when a daughter-in-law is let out, some people throw dirt at her, some ashes, and some cow dung, without realizing that they are repeating an ancient observance. What was considered bad form in those days is now considered good form. And those beings who in those days indulged in sex were not allowed into a village or a town for 1 or 2 months. Accordingly, those who indulged for an excessively long period in such immoral practices began to build themselves dwellings and houses so they could indulge undercover. And I'll stop there. It continues to go on. But I think one of the fun parts about that for me, as I was reading that, is now, just like when Eve realized she was naked and how filthy lust was and how filthy the human body was. So what did the Buddhists do? Well, they just built houses so they could have sex inside rather than outside, and nobody would know. And even today, if you think about it, if everybody here had sex outside, who would they call first? The police. And people would be ranting and raving, saying, "How could they do that? How ugly is that? Why don't they find a motel?" So even today, we haven't changed a whole lot from this creation theory. So this is yours. You can...
Thank you.
You're welcome.
One thing that really occurred to me, too, is the fall from this innocent state into a fall, you know, into a fallen state. And then it really rang with me when the... In the story of Moses, the promised land, the recovery of the pure state, is going to be a land of what? Milk and honey. Which is the original ghee, the milk-like substance that's so incredibly sweet.
Yeah.
That must be a very primal.
It must be something that humans have been attracted to for a really long time. Yeah.
Mother's milk.
Mother's milk.
Yeah.
The bee honey. And I understand the bees are starting to disappear now. So, and then when that happens, I guess we go in 4 years, from what I've heard. Okay, more questions. Was that okay? Did you enjoy the creation story of Buddhism? You know, it's interesting to see how humans evolve. And I guess every culture, every religion needs to have some kind of beginning story. Now, how did we get here? What does it all mean? And then it's our job, I suppose, to figure out what we're supposed to do once we got here. But they give us an idea of how it started, and some religions give us an idea of how it's going to end. So you have those apocalypse myths and things, which some people don't feel they're myths. Some people, when I went to visit New Harmony, Indiana, it used to be a religious commune a couple hundred years ago, and they had these tall watchtowers that people in the religious community would crawl up every day and look all day long. And what they were looking for? They were looking for the end of the world. And then they would alert everybody else, it's finally come. Very interesting. And those watchtowers are still there. And I guess the Jehovah's Witnesses, do they have a publication called The Watchtower?
I didn't know that.
I think they might. Somebody has a publication called The Watchtower.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they come door to door. So the watchtower may have something to do with the apocalypse, you know, of the end. Okay, class 955, I guess that's you guys, huh? How did you become a Buddhist? Well, it's a short story. I became a Lutheran because I was born, and then I became an agnostic because I went to high school. And then I became a Buddhist because I turned 30. And so there was a sort of a whole journey there that I won't go into great detail, but the point of turning 30 for me was being 30 was really old back in the 60s and 70s. It was like you cross over to the other team, you know, and so I realized because I had now turned 30, I might die soon because, I mean, how old could I get? You know, 30 seemed to be pretty old at the time. And so I figured if I was going to die, I might as well have a good religion. And so I bought a book by Houston Smith, World Religions, and I read the chapter on Buddhism twice. And then I found a phone book and a meditation center. And so it was a very practical way of getting my religion. I did it because I was going to die. And what happened, ironically, is when I became involved in my religion, I really started to learn how to live. Though my intention was to die well, I was able to find out how to live well. And I suppose most religions are designed to do that, that you go and you find your religion or your parents give you a religion, and it allows you to give meaning to this sort of meaningless existence we have. You know, what is the meaning of life to a Buddhist? It's a tough one. I don't know. I haven't figured that out yet. But Buddhism gives us something to do until we figure out what the meaning is. So we have a practice and we have, yeah.
How can you be so sure that you'll eventually reach nirvana? Or is that your personal belief?
Okay, that's a good question. Not sure at all. The only thing I know is that if I practice long enough, performance will occur. Now, what does that mean? That means that a couple months ago, I went to eBay and bought my very first mandolin. And it is so much fun. It's a solid mahogany, all wood mandolin.
King of instruments.
And it's tuned just like a violin, I found out. And so I have absolutely no musical talent at all. But I find if I practice long enough, it appears that I do have talent. And so practice eventually turns into performance. And so as a Buddhist, our job is to practice. And eventually that practice will evolve into nirvana. So am I sure that it will happen? No. But It's more likely to happen if I have a practice. And I'm more likely to play the mandolin if I practice it. So it's that, sort of that kind of thing. So I suppose you could call it faith, but I prefer to call it confidence. Confidence, for me, happens when it self-validates. And so my personal Buddhist practice self-validates a lot. And that gives me confidence that this is a path that works. Well, the kind of things that help me self-validate is the fact that if I do meditation on a regular basis, I have more patience and kindness. I'm less likely to be angered at stupid things that happen every day anyway. I tend to be more peaceful if I meditate, and that gives me confidence that it's working. So rather than medicate, I meditate. And if I read the sutras and the teachings of the Buddha and apply them to my everyday life, I see that they work. That the people, even though that's a teaching that's 2,500 years old, 25 plus, the people haven't changed very much. We're pretty much the same kind of humans we were back then. We just have iPods now and computers, you know. But everybody gets angry. Everybody gets lustful. Everybody is greedy, and everybody is deluded, and some lesser and some more. So that's how I sort of get confident, and I can see that it applies even today. Does that make sense, Sona?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Anybody else have a question before we go on to the next? Okay, good. Your website has a link regarding Buddhist Catholic dialogue. Are there any Catholics in here? Okay, one Catholic. Okay, and one Buddhist. Have you participated? These two seem very much seem like such different religions. What connections or topics have you explored? Well, this is a wonderful question because this past October, I was invited to go to the second Monks in the West Conference. And we had 15 Buddhist monks and 15 Catholic monks come together at St. John's Abbey, which is in Collegeville, Minnesota. It's a university, but it's also a monastery where they have 80 or 90 Catholic monks living and practicing. And we had a four-day conference on celibacy. And my job was to give the opening presentation for the Buddhists and why Buddhists are celibate. And then we had a Catholic talk about why Catholics are celibate. And then two other, a Buddhist and a Catholic, talked about how to stay celibate. What kind of practices do you do? And then we had two others, a Buddhist and a Catholic, talk about what happens when you break your vow. You know, what are the penalties of not being celibate? And so I think the things that Catholics and Buddhists have in common right off the bat is they both come from monastic traditions. Now, the Buddha is monastic. And when I use the word monastic, it includes celibacy and renunciation. The Buddha was celibate because he achieved nirvana. He wasn't celibate because anything was wrong with sex. You know, sex is sort of really good. And a lot of people enjoy doing it. And that's why we're all here. But Siddhartha, before the Buddha, had a concubine. He had dancing girls. And he got married at 16. And so he enjoyed his sex. And then he had his first child at 29. But when he achieved his nirvana at 35, he ended all desire. And because he didn't have desire, he didn't have any more sex. So a Buddhist would say there's nothing wrong with sex. There's something wrong with the desire for sex because that desire can't be satisfied by having sex. Catholics look at it a little bit differently. You know, and I thought it was interesting, you know, because I guess the original Catholics weren't celibate. You know, they could have, you know, wives and children and stuff. And then the church and the Catholic priests were having issues with property, if I'm not mistaken. There was a thing about, well, you know, I've got a wife and a son, and I'm a Catholic priest, and I built this church, and I want to give the church to my son. And the Catholic church said, well, no, it's our church. You can't own a church. It's our church. And so they sort of, you know, had the celibacy thing happen then. And said, okay, from now on, you know, you Catholic priests can't have sex anymore because we don't want you to have children and families and stuff. That's one of the reasons. There's a lot of other reasons too, but that's the one reason I sort of hooked on to. So we come from a monastic tradition, and that's where people leave their home life to go into a monastery or a center or a temple and live in a community with other people. Now, as it turns out, when you live with other people, it's just like living with your family. You know, I know at the center where I live, we have 30 people that live at our center. Most of them aren't Buddhists, but they live there because rent's cheap. And they have backyards and dogs and cats and fish and birds and stuff like that. And the people at the center where I live are the last ones to congratulate me and the first ones to condemn me. And that's really healthy. I am so happy that not everybody looks at me as being such a wonderful person. Because think of the ego I would have. So every time I go back to the meditation center, I'm just somebody that lives there. Nothing special. But every time I get to go out and make a presentation, oh, I can be special for a half hour, an hour. And how lucky is that? So we live in community because it's good for our mental health and because a lot of people living together can live inexpensively. We can share cars and we can share bathrooms and kitchens and TVs. And so all of us don't need a kitchen or TV or bathroom or car. That's the theory behind community. And so it works well. In America, when you're really successful, you get to live all alone on top of a hill with a big gate and cameras to keep everybody out. And so in the monastic tradition, when you're really successful, you get to live with a lot of people and share stuff. And I think it works better that way. We have a lot in common when it comes to our religious practice. But when it comes to our end goal, we have to part ways because we don't have the same end in mind. Our practice is designed to make us free, ultimately free. The practice of Catholicism is designed, it seems to me, to create a relationship with God and to live forever with God in heaven, which is really a nice thing to have happen. You know, but a Buddhist wouldn't want to go to heaven and be with God. A Buddhist would want to be free. So we have to be free of even being a Buddhist. Our job is to go beyond being a Buddhist. So it's a little different. But we do have a lot in common. And there, in 1968, I think it was 68, it might have been earlier, maybe 66. Anyway, the late 60s, they had something called the Second Vatican Council in Rome. And this is where bishops came together. And they signed this document called Nostra Aetate. And in this document, they say that Buddhism is okay. The Catholic Church said Buddhism is a valid religion, and it works. And ever since then, Buddhists and Catholics have been talking to each other. And they've been dialoguing in Los Angeles. We have a Buddhist-Catholic dialogue we just met yesterday at the center where I live. And they've been doing that once a month since 1989, talking about different things. And we're now talking about violence. Is there a just war in Buddhism? Is there a just war in Catholicism? So we're exploring that subject now. And it's really interesting.
Can you say a little
bit
about that?
About a just war?
Yeah.
Well, I can tell you from the Buddhist standpoint, there is no just war, but war may be necessary. But see, we don't have somebody that can forgive us for going to war. We have karma, and karma never forgives you. So if you go out and kill a lot of people, even if it's for a good reason, there are karmic consequences to killing anything in Buddhism. So whereas God might forgive a Catholic soldier, karma will not forgive a Buddhist soldier. And so the reason monks give back their ordination when they go to war is because if they fight and kill as a monk, their karmic consequences are 10 times greater than if they fight and kill as a layperson. So a lot of Buddhist monks would protect their country because that's where they're born. Then the idea of protecting your country is very important to most people because we seem to be very tribal and we seem to, you know, this is ours and that's yours and we want to protect ours. So there's a tradition of monks giving back their ordination, becoming soldiers, fulfilling their duty to their country, and then taking the robes up again and being a monk again.
Is that what you mean by fighting war that's necessary?
Yes. Yeah, sometimes it's necessary.
Protect your country.
Well, for instance, in my last newsletter that I sent out, I can send you copies, Buddhism and Violence. And there was a really interesting article I found. If a man gets married and has a family, his duty as a husband and father is to protect his family, even if it means killing in order to do that. And that's what's found in Buddhism. So you really can't say that Buddhism is ultimately pacifistic. And we would, you know, that if somebody comes in to kill your family, you would let them, because that's their karma. And then you would continue your life. So it's sort of an interesting paradox for Buddhists to say, okay, it's appropriate in some cases to use defensive violence, but it's never appropriate to use offensive violence. And if you've taken martial arts, most martial arts I'm aware of is defensive rather than offensive. And so it's appropriate to be aggressively defensive if you're a martial artist, but it's not appropriate to be offensive. So I think it's an interesting dilemma we face as we make our choices in the world. Well, what am I going to do? Am I going to, you know, protect my family, or am I going to let my family die? Am I going to protect myself, or am I going to let myself die? In Cambodia, with Pol Pot, during the Vietnam War, many, many thousands of Buddhist monks were killed, because they were trying to get rid of the intellectuals and the religious and make it a agricultural society, which would be easier to manipulate. And I don't think those Buddhist monks fought back. They were in their robes. I think they realized that they were going to have to die anyway one day, and maybe this was the day for whatever reason. But it's just a sad commentary, you know, that we tend to kill the weakest and go to war with the strongest, and then kill them eventually.
Can that be seen as a form of attachment? That you're, if you're fighting to protect yourself, to protect your family, to protect your country, that, you know, that's kind of going against the idea of non-self that Buddhists are striving for. And so that would be, to embrace death would be, in that situation, would be a form of non-attachment?
I would say no, and I'll give you a couple reasons. Okay. Did anybody see the movie 300? Okay, one. Okay, cool movie, huh? Any of the women see 300? Okay. It was more of a guy's movie. But they did have the women Spartans, and the women gave birth to the Spartans. So women were also looked at as being strong. But did the Spartans die because they were selfless? Because they had, because they weren't attached to their life. Were they willing to 300 to go fight a million because they were not attached? Absolutely not. Why were they at war? That was their duty as a warrior. That's what they were trained for. They were trained to die in glory. They were trained to die in battle. And one of my favorite lines was, "Spartans tomorrow breakfast in hell." You know, as they faced their opponents. You know, so there was sort of an enthusiasm for this process of life and death. As a Buddhist, if you give up your life too early, you may not have achieved your final goal. And then you have no idea of how many rebirths it will take to come back as another human being and find the Dharma and be able to practice and achieve nirvana. So every lifetime as a human being is a precious one, and you want to use as much of it as you can to liberate yourself. So there is this wonderful ideal about being selfless and, oh, well, it doesn't matter. But it does matter, because now you're going to be coming back and again and again and again. So I would say there is this idea of self-protection in Buddhism, even though the ultimate is selflessness. and that's another challenge of giving meaning to, well, how attached should I be to my life? Is my life useful to others? And if I'm not here, will others suffer more than if I was here? And then wouldn't it be selfish rather than selfless to let your life go? Like with people like Mother Teresa. I mean, I would hate to see her, you know, go any sooner than she had to. You know, the last pope, even though he was just struggling with his medical conditions, he was still useful to many, many millions of people. So yeah, the idea of dying can be looked at as selfless and also selfish. In my mind.
Have
I stimulated any questions so far?
Yeah. Because
this is just a script here. So if we can make it spontaneous. Did you have a question?
Well, I actually have a little more of a question about the whole relationship thing that I've seen more about Buddhism. But,
okay.
I was hearing talk about, and it was called Who Are You?
Yes.
Yeah,
how was that talk?
I liked it.
Okay.
But I was wondering, because you shared a story about the young man who was Catholic, and he said that he was with his sick mother who's taking care of her, and he said that he saw the face of Christ on her. And I was just wondering, like, would that, I was a little confused about Buddhism and how that would be looked at, because if we're all, like, I don't really know how to articulate it, but if we're all one.
Okay.
If I'm, why would him seeing the face of Christ on his mom, like, why wouldn't that be the equivalent of me seeing my face on someone else? Or, I don't know, I was just confused on how that related to Buddhism.
Okay, well, that's really good. And one of the words you used just triggered about 12,000 sentences in my head. And that was, we're all one. And as a Buddhist, I would have to say, absolutely not. We're all connected. Now, is there a difference between oneness and connectedness? I think connectedness allows us to have individuality. And it allows us to create community. Oneness seems to allow us to create uniformity. And some people feel very comfortable in uniformity. If everybody thinks like I do, then I must be right. Some people get challenged when people have different thoughts and look different, because how can I relate to them? But a Buddhist would say, well, even though you can't see the connection, we're all connected. And it seems to me, if you were a religious person and looked at Christ as the ideal, for me, Christ went from Jesus to Christ in the way Siddhartha went from Siddhartha to the Buddha, that there was a worldly aspect to Jesus and there was a spiritual aspect to Christ. There was a worldly aspect to Siddhartha and there was an enlightenment aspect to the Buddha. And sometimes, if that's our ideal, if you're a devout Christian or devout Christian, and you look at someone and see Christ's face, you know, that's how they feel, too, when they see Christ's face. You know? You have no choice. You cannot walk away. You cannot turn away. This is Christ you're looking at, and he needs your help. So how could you possibly think that you could ignore him? And that's what I see when I was listening to this fellow talk. I just saw that he had no choice. That his mother was a person who allowed him life, and she nurtured him when he couldn't nurture himself, and she was always there for him. But now to see your mother and to see Christ at the same time must have been just a joy. The sadness of watching your mother die and the joy of being present in Christ, what a wonderful experience that must be, you know? So that's sort of what I meant by that. Is that helpful?
Yeah, just when I was listening to it, I just sort of made me wonder about the relationship.
Have you ever seen Christ in somebody?
No.
I haven't seen the Buddha in anybody either. Yeah. I guess they're probably out there. I don't know where. Maybe in the shelters, where they're supposed to be, you know. They sure aren't in politics. Anybody else? Anybody else have another question? God, are you feel comfortable with the Buddhist concept of God? Did you read that little... yes. Okay, God.
The concept of Anatman. Is it... I don't know. To me, it seems just kind of empty.
Ah, you've been reading.
Like a
have you been reading Zen? Those are very good words you're using.
My book?
Okay, because those words are very good. You got the right words. Okay. Anatman, in Pali they would say anatta, would be not self. In Mahayana Buddhism, the later form of Buddhism, it would be shunyata. Shunyata would be emptiness. Now, let me talk about this, because this was so hard for me to understand. I had to buy a book and read the book to really get the full meaning of anatta and shunyata, emptiness and not self. And that book was The Spectrum of Consciousness by Ken Wilber. It was the first book he wrote. He was in his 20s going to university to get a PhD and working in a kitchen as a dishwasher. And he wrote this book. Now, does that paint a great picture? You know? And he was a meditator. He was a Zen meditator. And he wrote about consciousness. And in the beginning, when I came to the problem of not self, I thought our job as a Buddhist was to kill the self. I thought the self was a problem. And if I could kill the self, I would be free. And I would be acting spontaneously in every moment, without any pre-thought, without any past or future. And then it came to me, if I got rid of myself, I would end up like Ronald Reagan. Now, Ronald Reagan had Alzheimer's. And if you lose that self, you can't even find the door. You don't know what food is. You're so in the present moment. You're so out of past and future that your life becomes impossible to live without the help of others. It'll come to me. There was a movie about this guy living in the present, Memento? I think it was Memento, living in the present moment. And it was a trippy movie because, you know, the guy was at a bar and he had a beer. And somebody just leaned over and spit in his beer, if I'm not mistaken. And then he turned away, and he had forgotten when he turned away that somebody had spit in his beer, because he was just in the present moment. And he just drank that. And I went, ew. But he couldn't even, you know, hold on to like 30 seconds of memory. And he would take pictures and write names, and when he came to somebody who seemed like they knew him, he would go through his pictures and get the name and stuff. He was trying to live without past and future. So the idea in Buddhism is not to kill self, because it would make us, it would handicap us as a human being. The idea in Buddhism is to not be the self. That the self is nothing more than a process. And this process occurs because of conditions. It occurs because of the human birth we've taken, and because we have a body and a mind. And we were given this gift of self. It is a gift. It's not the enemy, it's a gift. The problem with self, though, is not a very good master. Its agenda is rooted in our survival. And so if you listen to everything self says, it's all about you. Now, to transcend that, and instead of having self as your master, having self as a tool. Using self to benefit you and others. Now we're going to go from anatta to emptiness. What is emptiness? Emptiness in Buddhism means empty of independent existence. And what the heck does that mean? To me, it means this. One of my favorite books, and I talked about it on my podcast, is Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, because I ride a motorcycle sometimes. And he was a professor, and he gave an assignment to his class to write an essay on quality. And you could pick anything you want. You could pick a brick wall, a Mercedes-Benz, or a diamond, and write this essay on quality. And everybody turned in a blank sheet. Nobody could write about quality. We all seem to know when quality exists. But if we try to figure out where it comes from, we always end up with emptiness. So I imagined in this book, if they had taken their motorcycles apart to find the quality of their motorcycle. And so now they're looking at the rims and the clutch pedals, and they're looking at the gears and the engine, and where is the quality of the motorcycle? It doesn't exist in any of the parts. But when all the parts come together and create one, oneness gives the illusion of quality. Oneness gives the illusion of self. Oneness gives the illusion that we can be independent of conditions. Wow, that is so cool. So when we look at ourselves, we are seeing one. We're not seeing many connected. We're not seeing teeth and eyes and hair and fingernails. And all these things come and are connected and create us. We go from many connected to one. So, a definition for emptiness would be empty of independent existence. Nothing exists independently in this world of samsara. All things are interconnected and interdependent. But when those things become one, we have the illusion of self, we have the illusion of quality, we have the illusion of independence. Enlightenment for me, and that was one of the questions, the difference between enlightenment and nirvana. Enlightenment for me is the direct experience of the interconnectedness and interdependence of all phenomena. Nirvana for me is the direct realization of the end of suffering, of ultimate happiness. Nirvana for me can be defined as the end of karma and the end of all future rebirths. So as a Buddhist, I am trying to achieve nirvana so I can end my karma. I want to end my karma because karma is what's being reborn lifetime after lifetime. I'm here today because my parents had sex and I had karma. I couldn't prevent my parents from having sex, but I might be able to prevent karma from going to the next lifetime. If I'm not born, I never have to get sick. If I'm not born, I never have to get old. If I'm not born, I never have to die. But most people wouldn't choose non-existence as an end goal because it sounds like such a boring thing. Are you trying not to exist, Kusala? And I would say no. What I'm trying to do is exist without being born. If I can exist because of my nirvana and not because of birth, then I'll never have to get old, I'll never have to get sick, and I'll never have to die. I'll never have to suffer again. I'll always be happy. Most cool. Thanks for the question. I hope it wasn't too long an answer. Does anybody else have any more questions? Yeah.
In Buddhism, are there specific teachings against homosexuality or just against desire in general?
Okay, cool. This is really an important question. How does Buddhism feel about being gay? There's nothing talked about in any of the sutras about being gay at all. The Buddha didn't say anything about it. He did talk about being gay when he talked to the monks and nuns, because he said you can't have any kind of sex. You can't have sex with animals. You can't have sex with your own gender. You can't have sex with yourself. You can't have sex with the opposite gender. No sex. So if you're a monk or a nun, he had a lot to say about being gay. But he also had a lot to say about being straight. If you would ask me how I feel about being gay, I think it's just another way to suffer. Because I look at people who are straight and they're suffering a lot. I look at people who are gay, they're suffering a lot. I look at people who aren't having sex, they're suffering a lot. It's just another way to suffer. So we don't have anything in Buddhism that says it's bad or good. We just never got there. Is that a good answer? Okay, you're welcome. How much time do we have?
Another 5 minutes.
Okay. I did.
Oh, good.
And
you don't have your mandolin in there.
I didn't, but I should have brought it. Do you play mandolin?
Okay. A little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that a great instrument? It has such a sweet voice, doesn't it? So I did bring my harmonica, though. And just maybe some little music to make us smile after all this suffering and life and death, you know? Oh, man. Okay. I feel better.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a good day today. Everybody's smiling now. That's so cool. Okay. Well, that's it. That was my talk at Chadwick School in Palos Verdes, California. Hope you found it interesting. Hope you found it useful. If you'd like more information about me, please visit my website, kusala.info. That's kusala.info. If you'd like to download some free ebooks on Buddhism, please visit buddhabooks.info. That's buddhabooks.info. If you'd like to listen to more podcasts I've done and interviews I've done, please go to dharmatalks.info. That's dharmatalks.info. And if you'd like to email me, I'm falling behind on my email responses, but if you're patient, I'll get to you. You can email me at kusala@urbandharma.org. That's kusala@urbandharma.org. Well, until the next time, until the next podcast, be happy, be peaceful, and most of all, be free from suffering.